The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So nice to be here. Part of what attracted me to the Buddhist path is the promise that there are ways of living, there are ways of practicing that leaves nothing out. There are ways of relating to the entirety of our life, our emotional lives, our behavior, our engagement with the world, where everything, every aspect of our life has a place on the path. And part of what attracted me to this path was that the Buddha promises different forms of well-being. You know, the kind of special forms of well-being that sometimes gets called enlightenment, and more kind of ordinary ways of thinking about well-being, casual well-being. And I'm personally interested, and I think people in general, practitioners, are interested in different forms of happiness. Gill says, that's one of Gill's great lines, like that this path is not about going from A to B, but going from A to A. So the question is like, what is it, what is A like? Or put differently, how can we characterize some of the changes going from A to A? How can we characterize some of the forms of well-being of this path? And I would say that there are primarily two ways we think about change on this path. Two types, forms of well-being that are developed. One form is the sudden awakening side. Yeah. So there's all this talk about enlightenment, right? The sudden awakening side. But then complementing that, supporting that, is the gradual cultivation side. And the sudden awakening side is a kind of dichotomous yes, no. That's usually how it's characterized. It's like enlightened, not. The cultivation side is characterized more as a kind of continuum. And we can move along that continuum in some way. And so I want to talk a little bit about these two sides of the path, and specifically about some of the problems that come up when we emphasize one to the detriment of the other. Does that make sense? When we make practice exclusively about sudden awakening, or exclusively about cultivation, there are something important gets left out. And my experience, my own practice, seeing so many people, is that both sides of these the practice are really important. So the Buddha says, characterizes this as this teaching as the middle path. And we usually think about it as avoiding the extremes of one side or another. Yeah, okay, so we avoid self-mortification and we avoid indulgence. And the middle path is between. But the middle path is also between two wholesome things. The middle path is finding a balance between acceptance and making change, between compassion and equanimity, between wisdom and love. And my sense is that we need that same kind of balanced relationship when we think about enlightenment and cultivation. So on the awakening side, when the path is just becomes about having a particular insights, the kind of cardinal experiences. And the cultivation side is dismissed or de-emphasized. There are problems. And so sometimes sometimes there's a feeling I have in with teachings that it's like enlightenment is being dangled out there like the biggest carrot of them all, you know? And there's a sense of, the word even gets used, deliverance. You know? And that... that can really, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to some of that, but it can distort our practice in a way if we're not really careful how we relate to that. And so, one teacher, a great teacher, but sort of epitomizes this approach. And what he said was, every moment is all or nothing. You either wake up or you don't. Yeah. When I heard that, I was like, that is pretty stimulating for me. You know, every moment is all or nothing. And it's beautiful the way that can inspire a lot of dedication or renunciation, curiosity, persistence. But there's another side of it, which is that this often devolves into a kind of another form of clinging. And I think... virtually everyone who's practiced on this path for decades knows phases when, unbeknownst to them, they were living like in the shadow of kind of clinging to particular outcomes. Of trying to make something happen in their practice. This has definitely caused a lot of a lot of suffering for myself. And so this way of relating to awakening can tends to have the exact opposite effect than some of the freedom that it's pointing to, namely the fixation of self. That is, we hear lines like the one I just mentioned, and almost immediately it puts us into like this back corner of the self, where we're in this mode of like, okay, I either wake up or I don't, and how am I doing? What's going on with me? Why isn't my path unfolding like that? Or, and so the notion of like the self is not enlightened and then we're going to get something. This is a kind of confusion and a form of spiritual materialism, to use a phrase from Trungpa Rinpoche. So this is what Trungpa says. It's important to see that the main point of any spiritual practice is to step out of the bureaucracy of ego. This means stepping out of ego's constant desire for a higher, more spiritual, more transcendental version of knowledge, religion, virtue, judgment, or whatever it is the particular ego is seeking. One must step out of spiritual materialism. If we don't step out of spiritual materialism, if we in fact practice it, then we may eventually find ourselves possessed of a huge collection of spiritual paths. Our vast collections of knowledge and experience are just part of the ego's display, part of the grandiose quality of ego. Even when practitioners have these kind of awakening experiences, the ego can kind of crystallize around anything. It wants everything for itself. It does not tolerate goodness outside of itself, in a way. And the image that I have is like an amoeba, that like a little particle of food comes, and then the amoeba just like forms, right? I'm like remembering like eighth grade biology, right? Forms around that food particle, and it just like incorporates it into itself. And it's the same thing, the way ego relates to spiritual attainments, to awakening, often. And so what people get is maybe that insight fades to some extent, or the experiential flavor of freedom isn't there in the same way. And then the ego kind of takes possession of that insight. And what we're left with is not freedom, but a self that thinks it's special. Now, in fixating on the liberating, you know, the sudden awakening side of our practice, we also want to be sure not to overestimate what awakening type experiences buy us. And this is a really, I think, important question in modern Dharma. It's like, what do these experiences buy us, and what don't they buy us? And I think it's very rare that people feel like, just my experience in seeing practitioners is there's so much left, even with deep, wide open, penetrating insight. There's so much left, actually, to do. And, you know, part of this, these reflections come up for me around seeing deep teachers who it's very clear to me, to others, that they've had lots of deep experience, but they've still been capable of doing a lot of harm. And that's been kind of heartbreaking for me personally. Maybe in part because there's some, it's a sort of a coming of age disillusionment. But that's only part of it. Part of what is provocative for me is that what it means to me is that liberating insight is still compatible with harmfulness. And that kind of casts a little bit of a shadow over enlightenment. Because ultimately, I the insight that I care about is so closely tied to love. That I've had to kind of reformulate how I think about enlightenment, given that it does seem compatible with some real harmful behavior. So there's there's so much that needs to be cared for, even when people do have the sudden awakening side. And in fact, most of the time, when the mind opens in those ways, the primary effect is to deepen people's commitment to the path. That's one of the sort of key outcomes of those insights is actually to that doubt dissolves entirely. Doubt in one's own capabilities and doubt that there's something that has to be done in this lifetime. But emptiness isn't the only form of medicine on this path. And there's this cultivation side too. Leonard Cohen puts it this way. In a poem he said, I know your burden's heavy as you wheel it through the night. The guru says it's empty, but that doesn't make it light. Yeah. Okay, so some of the complications of focusing or almost fetishizing enlightenment. But we should be careful not to choose the other side, which is to reduce the path just to cultivation. And so we see this a lot. That there are, you know, increasingly as the Dharma, as the Buddhist teachings, this path is more widely disseminated in our culture. We see kind of more therapeutic versions of the Dharma, where the aspirations are much lower. This has been one of the critiques of some of the ways that the Dharma has made its way into the secular world. And I'm involved in mindfulness, secular practice, and am deeply moved by it. I find it very beautiful. Sometimes what's presented, the way that well-being is presented in those settings, is that it's just a quantitative difference. That mindfulness practice is basically just getting a bit more of the goodness we already have. But the Buddha was radical and suggested that there are qualitatively different forms of happiness. That it's not just the more of the same, but that we've really underestimated the capacity of the mind, the capacity of the heart. And in a way, we've sold ourselves short. And so any path that leaves out some of these radical possibilities is not complete. Now, I said that that emptiness doesn't solve all problems, and that's true. Sometimes the approach that people use to untangle a particular form of suffering is to try to have deep insight, to try to wake up to the emptiness of the phenomena. But sometimes that's not the right medicine, as Leonard Cohen was alluding to. Now that said, emptiness is not the medicine for all disease, but there are some illnesses for which it's the only medicine. That is, there's a certain kind of quiet rumbling of dukkha, of dissatisfaction in the mind. And it's so pervasive that we've just kind of acclimatized to it. And it reminds me of a kind of like a loud refrigerator or a diesel truck engine that's like out there and not real loud, but loud enough so that we're all hearing it. And if it first just showed up, we would really notice it. But if it were there for years, we would stop hearing it in the same way. And there are forms of dukkha that are like this. So the Buddha actually directs our attention to them, says, like, okay, look at the sense of incompletion. To actually sense into the sense of that the objects of the world cannot quench this longing. And I have experiences, you know, beautiful experiences that are very pleasant, nourishing, wholesome, and you have these two. And yet the something that kind of, even amidst that joy, there is a sense of nothing can fully deliver. Like it can be great. It's way better than not having the goodness. And we should pursue it. But it can't, it doesn't quiet the rumbling engine. And so there is this this longing to heal a kind of fundamental alienation, or to be more connected in a way. Like sometimes when I'm with a loved one, I feel like I'm trying to be, the connection feels great and beautiful, but it's like I don't want to stop, you know, I want even more connection. And there's almost a sense of an unbridgeable divide at moments. And the Buddha was proposing that we can bridge that divide. And so we come to honor this longing to be free, to know forms of well-being that really feel complete and feel like nothing's left out, nothing's missing. This is Nisargadatta. Who was born first, you or the world? As long as you give first place to the world, you are bound by it. Once you realize, beyond all trace of doubt, that the world is in you and not you in the world, right then and there, you're out of it. Of course, your body remains in the world and of the world, but you are not deluded by it. So I prefer to think about statements like that not so much as a commentary on the world, but actually as a depiction of experience, a phenomenological description of freedom. So, awakening, cultivation, and we need both, and they actually each supports the other. Each supports the other. And I would say that they converge in a life of harmlessness. At least that's where I hope they converge. think I'll stop. So we have time for about a few minutes for anything coming up for you or any practice questions, things maybe totally unrelated to any of this. Happy to interact with you a bit.
I suppose that I've been pursuing the gradual daily practice, yeah. And I'm looking for everyday happiness.
Yeah.
But I didn't know there was a practice to pursue enlightenment. I guess I sort of felt like the heavens gave you a bit when you were worthy. Okay, I'm also Christian. You can just hear it in me. I'm both. But how do you pursue enlightenment? I mean, I thought that sort of magic, just boom, you get it sometimes if you're lucky.
Your comment reminds me of, I don't know who said it, but it's like enlightenment is an accident and practice makes you accident prone.
Yeah.
You know, the practices, you know, are the practice for cultivation, the practice for enlightenment, are the same practice. Yeah. The same practices. But maybe usually the differentiator is the kind of energetic vigor with which we pursue the path. And but the practices are the same. And you know, at some level, what simplifies this for me is just to be attending to a very fundamental distinction. Suffering and non-suffering. And our practice is dedicated to the reduction of suffering. Sometimes that comes in the form of, on the gradual side. Sometimes it comes in the form of the awakening side. But the Buddha did say, like, please don't underestimate the capacity of your mind. And don't underestimate that. I want to say more, but I'm not sure what.
Yeah. Maybe it's best not to. There's a naive quality to my practice that I think keeps me from striving in it.
Keeps you from striving?
Yeah. I just sit.
You just sit, yeah.
And then I go back to the kids and the dog and the school and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I'm lucky, the next day I get to sit again without the kids and the dog, etc., for 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Well,
that's enough. That's so rich.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Maybe one thing I'll say is just to reflect a little bit on your intention for practice, and to explore what it is that you're doing in those 20 minutes, or how you're bringing that practice into your daily life. Like, what is animating it? And I'm not saying you have to change your intention. You have to be like, okay, I'm going to be Maitreya, Buddha of the age or something, you know. It's like, but like, what is your intention? Get clear on that. And when we have to listen deeply to, like, refine our intentions in a way. It sounds good, though. Yeah. Thanks.
Where? Thank you very much.
Sure.
Could you expand on the kinds of harm that you were alluding to in your talk? And I guess I would follow that up with, you mentioned about doubt, that we should not have doubt or should overcome doubt. Is that where you were going with that great harm remark you made during your talk?
No, but I'm glad you're asking because I want to clarify. So the harm that I was talking about was senior, you know, revere, and I'm not, I should clarify, I'm not talking about anybody in this community or anything. These are public kind of things, publicly acknowledged things, but senior teachers who combine deep wisdom with major and persistent ethical lapses that do harm primarily to students. And that's what I was that's what I was pointing to, and for me the question comes up like, okay, what are the mechanisms that make deep wisdom and harmful behavior compatible? Does that make sense? What are, like, how do those coexist? And what does it mean about the nature of that wisdom? Does that make sense? It doesn't mean there's no wisdom. You know, like, these are not charlatans. These are not people who are pretending to know things they don't know. These are people who know things and still did harm. And there are different ways of understanding how those two things coexist. But I'm sharing my own process here. You know, like I've been grappling with what the shadow of that harm means for the nature of enlightenment. It means something to me. I'm not totally sure what, but it means something. And one of the things it means is the cultivation side is indispensable. The cultivation side is usually what addresses the problematic ethical behaviors. Sometimes people have a kind of awakening experience and some really harmful pattern of behavior completely falls away. That does happen. But a lot of times, some of these habits are, they're like etched in granite. And it's the persistent day in, day out willingness to look that begins to heal some of these harmful patterns of behavior. Maybe one more if there's anybody. Yeah.
Thanks. One of your last remarks was that the enlightenment side plus the other side hopefully combine to make a life where we don't, a harmless life.
Yeah.
And my first response was, is that all we're trying to do, is be harmless? And I know you mean it in a deeper way, but I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah. harmlessness sounds... harmlessness sounds pretty good to me. To others, to self, I do mean it in a deep way. A lot of what we're doing in Dharma practice is seeing how we create harm. And the Buddha said that we create more harm for ourselves than we know. And that our freedom depends largely in stopping those kinds of harm. And the ways we stop is, it may be a simple choice we make, but some of it has to actually mature, and the problematic, the harmful habits have to fall away through a kind of the momentum of goodness, of wisdom, of mindfulness. And so when we're really not doing harm, it's a very free state of being. And in those times, it's the thought of doing harm doesn't, it's not like something we need to renounce and let go of. It just doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah. So when does the healing, the world healing come in?
Where does the world healing come in? The harmlessness in terms of isn't not just with respect to oneself, but everything we encounter, including the earth. Yeah. And so, it's my hope that you know, the flip side of harmlessness is really a life of service and giving. So the paths converge in harmlessness, we could say, or another word is love. Let's just sit for a moment. Thank you.